I'm David Hunt. In the conclusion of my two-part feature on Mecla, I'll examine the slow decline and demise of America's first gay and lesbian political action committee.
Mecla became involved because bathhouses were embarrassing to explain.
Mecla is dying a slow death, she said in September 1991. That was the problem, literally, not figuratively. A scan of the obituary section of the Los Angeles Times tells the story.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Daniel Wasias. 56 men are arrested at a so-called gay sex party in Jakarta. Argentina's president decrees an end to gender-affirming healthcare for young people, and AIDS kills America's first queer political action committee. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Elena Botkin-Levy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 15th, 2025. Indonesian authorities are calling it a gay sex party. They arrested 56 men during a raid at a private gathering in a Jakarta hotel on February 1st. Police spokesman Aid Ari Siam Indradi told a press conference, "The event was merely based on pleasure that they wanted to seek. Condoms and HIV medications were also seized." The suspects are being charged under the nation's pornography laws and face a minimum of 2 years in prison. Two men who allegedly rented the hotel room and another who allegedly invited the partygoers could be in jail for up to 15 years if convicted. Sex between men is technically not illegal under Indonesian secular law. However, LGBTQ people face routine discrimination and harassment in the primarily Muslim nation, and when arrested, they're charged with other crimes. John Sifton is the Asia Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. He told Metro Weekly, "The prosecution of people under the anti-pornography law is one problem. Those who are arrested are sometimes beaten, extorted for money, and have their property confiscated from them. There are also provisions in the penal code against obscene acts by others with third parties that they've used to prosecute people as well." Indradi underscored the police's interest in both legal and social expectations. He concluded the press briefing about the raid with the troubling admonishment, "Let this serve as a reminder for everyone to uphold the law and moral decency."
Argentina's far-right president, Javier Milei, signed a decree this week banning gender-affirming healthcare for trans and non-binary patients under the age of 18. The decree also forces transgender inmates to be housed in jail facilities based on their birth gender. Presidential spokesperson Manuel Adorni explained that Milei's action had been informed by legislation restricting pediatric gender-affirming healthcare in the UK, Sweden, Finland, and the United States. It repeals a 2012 gender identity law that allowed the treatments with the consent of the young patient's parents or guardians. An official government statement argues, "Gender ideology, taken to the extreme and applied to children by force or psychological coercion, simply constitutes child abuse. Children do not have the cognitive maturity to make decisions about irreversible processes." The government failed to provide any evidence that children were being coerced to change gender or that puberty blockers and hormone therapies are irreversible. Milei created a stir at last week's World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, where he condemned wokeism, feminism, and climate activism, referred to LGBTQ people as pedophiles, and called Pope Francis a filthy leftist. That drew thousands of protesters into the streets of Buenos Aires. The global queer rights group ILGA World bemoaned developments in Argentina in a statement saying, "Argentina was a beacon in the region. By recognizing the right to gender identity without pathologization or judicialization, this regression, imposed by decree without parliamentary debate or the participation of the sectors affected, constitutes an abuse of executive power and a blow to democratic institutions.
Another president's attempt to ban gender-affirming health care for trans patients under the age of 19 by decree is being blocked by the courts. Judge Brendan Herson of the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland was the first to issue a temporary restraining order to halt a January 29th executive order by President Donald Trump. Herson's February 13th ruling granted the request from seven families with trans or non-binary children who are challenging the constitutionality of Trump's order. They're joined by PFLAG National and represented by queer and human rights legal organizations, including Lambda Legal and the American Civil Liberties Union. The temporary restraining order lasts for 14 days, but it can be extended, which seems likely. Observing the steep challenges already facing trans people, Herson wrote that Trump's executive order exacerbates and seems to deny that this population even exists or deserves to exist. The next day, U.S. District Court Judge Lauren King of the Western District of Washington granted a second temporary restraining order. This one in response to a lawsuit filed by three doctors and the Democratic Attorneys General of Washington State, Oregon, and Minnesota. Their lawsuit argues that Trump's order discriminates against patients on the basis of sex and additionally intrudes on states' powers to regulate medical care. Hospitals across the country have obeyed in advance and stopped dispensing puberty blockers and hormone therapy for their young trans patients, fearing the loss of federal funding. The temporary restraining orders should ensure that practitioners will continue or resume those services, at least for now.
Transgender and non-binary people are also suing the Trump administration over a presidential directive. Seven plaintiffs are challenging his demand that the U.S. State Department stop offering the X gender marker on passports and other federal government documents. The American Civil Liberties Union is representing them and says it has already heard from more than 1,500 trans people or their family members about difficulties they're having getting a passport. In the words of ACLU legal director Jesse Rossman, it's yet another example of the Trump administration attempting to deny the dignity of transgender people and trying to push them out of public life. We're challenging this unconstitutional passport policy because all people deserve the freedom to live their life safely and with dignity.
Finally,
hell no, we won't go! Hell no, we won't go! Hell no!
Hundreds gathered at the birthplace of the modern LGBTQ+ movement to protest another absurdly transphobic action by the Trump administration. Since by executive order, the United States now recognizes only two genders, the National Park Service has erased the T, Q, and plus sign from LGBTQ+ on the official website of the Stonewall National Monument. All references to transgender people are gone, and the word queer has disappeared. It's particularly ironic, as New York State Senator Brad Hoyleman Siegel told CBS News.
The transgender community threw the first bricks that launched the contemporary LGBTQ human rights movement.
Trans folks, especially trans women of color, black and brown trans women, were at the forefront of the LGBT movement back in 1969 when the Stonewall Inn was being raided.
Trans Latina activist Angelica Cristina spoke to WPIX.
And I always make sure to speak their names. Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, Miss Major Griffin Gracie, and queer people like Stormy DeLavier.
Another protester told Fox News 5.
It's not only about removing letters from our website, it's a coordinated attack to remove or try to erase trans, queer, non-binary people from the entire government system to say that we do not exist.
Gay New York City council member Eric Botcher also attended the rally.
Trump and his people are trying to cleave our community apart. They're trying to pit us against each other. They're not going to succeed.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul called the erasure cruel and petty. Kathy Rena of the National LGBT Task Force put it into perspective for ABC News.
It's just another part of the chaos and cascade of attacks that the queer community is facing under the Trump administration. The pendulum swings both ways and progress is not linear. No, we're not going anywhere.
The demonstrators at the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village have a warning.
For those who think that they're going to stop at T, they're going to remove all the other letters.
When they're done with us, they're coming for you!
When they're done with us, they're coming for you!
When they're done with us, they're coming for you!
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending February 15th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay healthy.
And I'm Elena Botkin-Levy. Stay safe. Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
It invented checkbook activism in the 1980s at the beginning of what seemed like a budding romance with a who's who of U.S. liberal politicians. In last week's first of a two-part series, we recounted the rise of MECLA, the Municipal Elections Committee of Los Angeles. However, in a system driven by money, even LGBTQ-supportive candidates become gold diggers, and MECLA discovered that money could ultimately not buy love. In the confusion of his two-part series, This Way Out's David Hunt reveals how the country's first gay and lesbian political action committee died.
In the 1980s, the Reagan Revolution swept the United States, turning the country to the right. As the gay and lesbian movement struggled for social and political acceptance, one group was thriving. MECLA, the Municipal Elections Committee of Los Angeles, used its wealth and influence to attract Democratic and Republican candidates to its events at luxury venues, such as the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. But the good times didn't last for long. This week, in the conclusion of my two-part feature on MECLA, I'll examine the slow decline and demise of America's first gay and lesbian political action committee. I'm David Hunt. In 1982, California Governor Jerry Brown appeared at one of MECLA's breakfast meetings to seek its endorsement and money for his Senate campaign. He had taken a fair amount of heat, Brown told the group, for supporting gay and lesbian causes.
In many ways, you gathered here this morning are exactly what people are talking about when they start their political assaults on my record and what I've been trying to do in Sacramento. There are code words, there are innuendos, but basically people don't like the fact that I've had a record of enfranchising the disenfranchised and representing the unrepresented.
It's true that, as governor, Brown had appointed gays and lesbians to positions of power in the state. He appointed MECLA board member Sheldon Andelson to the Board of Regents of the University of California, on the condition that Andelson sell his gay bathhouse, the 8709, in West Hollywood. And Brown appointed the state's first openly gay judge, Stephen Lax, to the San Francisco Superior Court, and the first out lesbian, Mary Morgan, to the San Francisco Municipal Court. Brown's appearance at the MECLA breakfast should have been a love fest, except someone asked Brown about his controversial decision to shelve a series of public service ads about AIDS, a disease increasingly claiming the lives of sexually active gay men. Brown waved off the issue, noting that the state was cutting spending across the board, not just in areas that affected gays. But he was pressed about the ads, which, it turns out, were already produced and already paid for. It wouldn't cost the state anything to spread the word about the emerging epidemic, and it might even save lives. Brown hedged.
I will review this matter carefully and slowly. And we will come up with a satisfactory solution relatively soon.
The audience laughed because they understood what Brown was really saying. He didn't want the ads to air until after he finished his campaign for Senate. He might be attacked during the campaign for spending money on gay health care while cutting other health programs. It was a fight he chose to walk away from. MECLA's board of directors voted overwhelmingly to endorse Brown, while recognizing that his support for the gay community had its limits. Brown ultimately lost the Senate race, and despite his promise, the public service ads never aired. MECLA, the first gay and lesbian political action committee in the United States, faced criticism in the early 1980s that it was too easy, that it demanded too little of the candidates it supported. The LA Weekly explained it this way. The real problem the new gay power structure poses is that it often reduces the political process to check writing, leaving the vast majority of gays disenfranchised. The grassroots can be trampled with such a strategy. Bella Abzug, the first representative to introduce a gay rights bill in Congress, addressed a MECLA breakfast a few months after Brown. She suggested that the group didn't have as much power as it thought it did.
I mean, women are not in the system. I mean, gays are not in the system. Minorities are not in the system. I mean, we got a few representatives here and there, but we're not in the system. We're outside of the power structure. There's no question about it. We're trying constantly to influence it, to push it, to give it money, to push it around, to say, listen, we got power, you better pay attention to us. But essentially, we're out of the system. So you pay a little attention to us because every vote counts. When 52% of the people in the country are voting, then every vote counts. So you can't take any chances. So you come around and you have a breakfast and a dinner and a lunch to all kinds of groups. Feminist groups and gay groups and old folks and... But anyhow, women are generally not in power. We know that. Even in this room, we don't seem to be in too much power. Laugh, but take it seriously. Anyhow, you don't mind my saying that, do you?
Stung by the criticism, MECLA tried to change the impression that it was a boys' club. I reported on MECLA's progress for Pacifica Radio after attending the group's annual fundraising dinner in 1985.
3 years ago, Bella Abzug surveyed a room full of men at a MECLA breakfast meeting and urged them to involve more women in the organization. Tonight, Geraldine Ferraro surveyed a dining room crowded with men and women at the Century Plaza Hotel and applauded their efforts to work together for human rights for all Americans. This year's dinner, MECLA's eighth annual, showed how far the organization has come in its efforts to include women, as well as men, Republicans as well as Democrats in its ranks. Ferraro talked of her growing awareness of gay and lesbian oppression and the need for oppressed groups to work together for social justice.
When we fight for the Equal Rights Amendment, it's not just because the Equal Rights Amendment is good for women, but because it's good for men and women together. And by the same token, when we fight prejudice based on sexual orientation, we not only protect the victims, we also heal the sickness that breeds irrational hatred. And that will be good for all the American people.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. The limits of MECLA's power became clear as it struggled to win passage of a gay employment rights bill, AB1, in the state legislature. The measure had been introduced 5 times since 1975 by San Francisco Assemblyman Art Agnos. It finally passed the legislature in 1984, only to be vetoed by Governor George Dukmejian. It's also true that for all the media attention Mekla generated, its budget paled in comparison to the dollars raised by rival groups on the right. While Mekla worked to raise $1 million to support friendly candidates in the decade of the 1980s, in 1 year alone, 1984, the Moral Majority raised $11 million for its right-wing lobbying efforts. To make matters worse, Mekla's board of directors decided to wade into a political battle that would divide the gay and lesbian community in 1985. It sided with conservatives on the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors and called for the voluntary closure of gay bathhouses. In Mekla's view, bathhouses were a public health threat because they fueled the spread of AIDS. Full stop. That view was shared by many of its supporters and, more importantly, by the California political establishment. Craig Hume, chair of Mekla's communications committee, explained.
Many members of the state assembly and state senate have indicated that they thought Mekla took a very responsible stand, which significantly enhanced the image of the gay community in the eyes of our elected officials.
Steve Downard, a bathhouse owner and head of the Silver Lake Merchants Association in Los Angeles, was one of Mekla's sharpest critics. In his view, the group cared more about public image than public health.
Mekla became involved because bathhouses were embarrassing to explain to their fabulous West Side friends. Well, maybe they have become like their fabulous West Side friends at Bel Air cocktail parties, but the rest of the gay community isn't. And the rest of the gay community may not have the affluence to defend their civil liberties as easily as the Board of Mekla.
In the end, the County Board of Supervisors opted to keep LA's 20 bathhouses open, but did require them to take steps to monitor and discourage unsafe sexual activity. If the controversy hurt Mekla's standing inside the gay and lesbian community, it boosted its reputation as politically pragmatic to the rest of the world. It helped Mekla court moderate Republicans, those could still be found in the 1980s, like former San Diego Mayor Pete Wilson, who had soundly defeated Jerry Brown in the 1982 race for the U.S. Senate in California. Wilson was warmly greeted at a Mekla dinner in July 1987, shortly after he successfully pressured the Reagan administration to create a National AIDS Commission. Wilson went on to win re-election to the Senate from California in 1988, beating his Democratic opponent, Leo McCarthy, by nearly a million votes. Then he surprised everyone by running for California governor in 1990. He beat former San Francisco Mayor Dianne Feinstein by about a quarter million votes. If Mekla thought it had a friend in the California governor's mansion, it was wrong. Less than a year into his term, Wilson vetoed AB1, the employment rights measure that Mekla and other gay organizations had been pushing for over a decade. Reaction in the gay and lesbian community was quick and fierce. Checkbook activism, critics said, was a fool's game. Judy Cisneros, a member of Queer Nation and ACT UP, two groups that embraced street protests, derided Mekla as gay assimilationists whose influence was waning. She told the LA Weekly, direct action and civil disobedience may become the most effective way to fight for broad-based recognition and laws in a society as resistant to gays and lesbians as ours. Even establishment figures such as Tori Osborne, executive director of LA's Gay Center, could see the writing on the wall. Mekla is dying a slow death, she said in September 1991. That was the problem, literally, not figuratively. A scan of the obituary section of the Los Angeles Times tells the story. One of Mekla's top donors, Sheldon Andelson, died of AIDS in December 1987. Mekla's first chair and one of its co-founders, Peter Scott, died of the disease in May 1989. By the early 1990s, the epidemic had claimed more members, including Mekla founders William Carey, Richard Kaplan, and Rand Schrader. As a result of the losses in its ranks, Mekla faced both a leadership void and what Osborne called grief overload. David Michener told the Los Angeles Times in 1992 that he had lost nearly 200 friends to the epidemic. Mekla's finances began to suffer. Co-chair Ryan Nakagawa told the LA Weekly that the group's annual budget had dropped tenfold, from $300,000 or more in the mid-1980s to just $30,000 in 1991. By 1992, Mekla was history. Co-founder David Mixner turned his talents to raising money for an old college friend who just happened to be a leading candidate for president. Reflecting on Mekla's demise, Mixner told the LA Weekly, "Mekla began to die a slow death as most of us began to turn our attention from gay issues to AIDS." But he defended the group's tactics, believing that courting and supporting gay-friendly candidates was necessary to raising the profile of a long marginalized movement. "As long as you believe the political process is important, you need checkbook activism," he said, "if you want to play politics." In its 15-year existence from 1977 to 1992, Mekla certainly played politics, and in a way that no one in the gay community had ever played it before, by the rules of the establishment, by cleaning up, dressing up, and sitting down with the politically powerful. If they didn't achieve everything they wanted, they at least were taken seriously by serious people. Morris Kite, the scruffy old-school activist who organized LA's first gay pride parade in 1970 and founded the Stonewall Democratic Club in 1975, was never invited to a Mekla dinner. I'm not sure he even owned a tuxedo. But he knew something about working inside and outside the system. "The movement needed to cultivate a good cop, bad cop strategy," he said in 1991, "combining street protest and political lobbying efforts. Mekla was needed," he said, "because some of us must know how to talk the language of legislators. And that language, as anyone can tell you, is money." Mekla is long gone, but its legacy lives on today in organizations like the Human Rights Campaign, the LGBTQ Victory Fund, and Equality California. I'd like to thank the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives for preserving many of the recordings heard on this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
To hear the full version of this feature, visit David Hunt's blog at www.tellmedavid.com. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Elena Botkin-Levy and Michael Taylor Gray, and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. Billy Joel, Alice Cooper, and Ite Kashti performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Harry Richardson of Socorro, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Daniel Macias. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WLSL St. Leo Dade City, Florida, CFUV Victoria, British Columbia, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, Washington, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.